And good evening. This is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And this is the second portion of our show where we get to interview an author. And I'm very honored to have one of the pioneers in the spiritual field on Intuitive Soul Radio, who has not only made spirituality a common practice, but as a result of your work, meditation and prayer has really become the practice for patients in the treatment of cancer worldwide. And it's no longer a spiritual practice, but accepted en masse due to your leading the path in cancer treatment. And since you've left your medical practice, has authored 8 books, and the last being 101 Exercises for the Soul, Simple Practices for a Health, Body, Mind, and Spirit, for Healthy Body, Mind, and Spirit. So I would really, really honored to welcome Dr. Bernie Siegel.
Thank you.
So usually what I like to do is to start talking about a little bit about, you know, what your journey has been. So, you know, your journey's been a long one, and you've been really in this field for a really long time. But what sort of got you to where you are now?
Well, I would say that, number one, Laurie, I became a doctor for healthy reasons, meaning I like people, not the human body, if you know what I mean. And then people come in it and you get into trouble. So I like people. But what you realize is then it becomes very painful to be a doctor because you can't cure everything. And you're not trained to deal with all those emotions and feelings. I mean, it's not something that gets discussed at medical meetings. Hmm. You know, it's about what do you think, not how do you feel. And one of my patients said this exact words to me when I went to a meeting that was designed to help cancer patients. And I thought it was a medical meeting because it was run by a doctor. But there were only 3 doctors there, two psychotherapists and myself, out of 125 people. And that blew my mind that all the doctors in our community didn't even show up for this meeting, which is designed to help cancer patients. But these are her exact words. She was sitting next to me. Again, no desk separating us. She said, "You're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me. So I need to know how to live between office visits."
Right.
And that was the beginning, you might say, of my spiritual journey, that suddenly I thought, wow, if I can help people live, then I don't have to feel like I've failed them. You know, I may not cure them, but at least I can help them live with their problem and confront their mortality and other things. So we started support groups over 30 years ago. I was amazed at how few people responded to my letter, which said, "You want to live a longer, better life, come to a meeting." These were, now understand, this is a letter from your doctor, not from a stranger.
Yeah.
And I expected 300 to 500 people to show up in response to the letter, you know, thinking, hey, doesn't everybody want to live a longer, better life? And less than a dozen women came to the first meeting.
Wow.
And so it also taught me, I don't know the people I'm taking care of. And it's part of why I've written, you know, more and more books. It's, you know, it's in a sense repeating the age-old message. So, yes, I write prescriptions for the soul, exercises for the soul. Now, am I saying anything new? Not really, but is it current and modern so people today can understand it and use it? Yeah. But I always say that what really struck me most of all was, I think the key element on our planet is how children are brought up. That if you're brought up with love, you're not self-destructive and not destructive of others. And it's an entirely different internal environment. And if something does come up, you're not afraid to participate because you're not looking at guilt, shame, and blame. You know, if I go to Bernie's group and I don't get better, it means I did something wrong. Mm-hmm. Or it's my fault I got sick, you know, because he wants to know what's going on in my life. But, and I was amazed that, you know, people were growing up with that because it may sound crazy to put it this way. My disadvantage was my parents loved me. I did well in school and I got along with God. So I didn't know what everybody else was going through. And that's why a lot of people got angry at me, you know, and say, "Oh, you're blaming. It's my fault." I mean, I've asked people, "What mottos do you live by?" Thinking of things that my parents said to me. And one man said, "You didn't ask us what mottos we're dying by." Mm-hmm. And here's a quote from one of the letters I have. "My mother's words were eating away at me and maybe gave me cancer." And this is a woman whose mother always told her she was a mess, a failure, embarrassed her, and dressed her in dark clothes so nobody would notice her. Now, when she got cancer, as she said, I went out and bought a red dress and red high-heel shoes. And she rebirthed herself, which is what I'm trying to get people to do. I mean, she changed who she is. Instead of continuing to resent and be bitter about her mother, she chose a whole new path, and it's why she's alive today, because of the message that her body got.
Right. Which is really important for us to understand. I mean, you know, the impact of blame and guilt that that does eat at us. I mean, I mean, that's really part of the problem. It's amazing. And yet, you know, I'm very spiritually inclined. I, you know, take good care of myself. But I can still get caught up in the everyday little things that, you know, that take us out of that place that we, you know, that you wonder why you would ever want to leave.
Well, that's part of why, you know, it's a constant process.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to remind people, and this, because what's literally true is, if you were in a play and it's a comedy and enhances immune function and stress hormone levels and everything else, if I put you in a tragedy, the opposite happens. So literally, I can get you sick in a play, see?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you're more likely to get the flu if I have you in Death of a Salesman than if you're in The Producers by Mel Brooks, you see, through the winter.
Right.
So what I keep saying to people is, you have to rehearse and practice. So when you do have a so-called bad day, you know, you don't start judging yourself and, oh, you're terrible and look what you're doing. It's, wait a minute, let me look at who I want to be. Who's my role model, say, and how should I behave today? And then you shift gears and get going again. And you let others be your coaches so that they give you feedback, they give you criticism, but you know it's aimed at making you a better person. See, it's not like mama telling you you're a failure, you embarrass us. No, that doesn't help you. But if it's, how can I be a better human being, more loving, more at peace, then people are helping you to have a better life. And when you heal your life, see, that was the other thing that I discovered, that when people heal their lives, they derive physical benefits, so that when people didn't die when they were supposed to, they always had a story to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a thing that, again, a lot of doctors never ask. If you have a miracle, a spontaneous remission, then, you know, what can you learn from the patient? It's spontaneous and miraculous. But somebody was reminding me in my first book, it's, you know, it's information about self-healing. I forgot I put that on the cover. It's self-healing, because I'm always talking about the book Cancer Ward by Solzhenitsyn. He uses the term self-induced healing.
Mm.
The men, all of whom have cancer, are talking, and one of them says, look, it says in this book there are cases of self-induced healing. And, yeah, see, when I read that in somebody else's words, it really, I thought, yeah, he knows, because he's had cancer, and he knows where he's coming from. But it's not an accident or lucky. It's self-induced because of changes you make. And it's becoming scientific, because I, again, was criticized. You know, oh, you're blaming your patient if you want to know what happened in their life. But now we know that simple things like laughter, you live longer if you're a cancer patient who laughs. And the laughter doesn't have to be due to something funny. I mean, you literally, I always say, anybody listening to this program, stop and laugh for 3 minutes. And watch how you feel at the end of 3 minutes. You'll find it hard to stop laughing, and you'll feel better. And even though there was no reason to laugh. And the other was a study on loneliness affecting the genes which control immune function. So think about a tragedy in your family and why somebody might get sick at that time. And that's why I started asking people, what's happened last year or two in your life? It wasn't to blame them or say it's your fault, but, you know, if a loved one died, if you moved across the country and were away from your family, even if your pet died, I mean, that there's something emotional going on that can make you vulnerable, and then to help them, in a sense, reclaim their life and relationships and connections and, you know, help themselves to heal.
Right. And, you know, I think you make a really great point. I mean, we do all of this work and we're trying to help people understand really their responsibility in their own healing. And when we do that, yeah, they start to think that we're blaming them. But, you know, there's so much more freedom in understanding that we're not a victim, that we have, that there are things, yes, that are not within our control. But when it comes to being in charge of our emotions and our emotional state and how we, our attitude towards life, these are things that we do have, that we can be in charge of. Right. We can shift them.
Well, I call it survival behavior. Yeah. Mm. In other words, there are patterns of behavior that survivors display. And so, again, if you said, okay, give me the list, and then I don't do well, you know, I do it wrong. No. See, and you used an important word, responsible. The word patient is derived from submissive sufferer. So I always say to people, if you're a good patient, I'm worried about you. Because then you don't speak up, you don't express your feelings, you don't ask questions, you just lie there. And you're more likely, literally, in the hospital to die of a medical error because people walk in, do something, and then they realize it was for the person in the next room. But you don't say anything. So I call it a responsible participant. I made up the word respant, R-E-S-P-A-N-T. I want you to be a responsible participant, that you have choices. You can say yes or no to treatments. I mean, this is your life, and you're the one who's in charge and should make the choices. And a lot of people, yes, they're afraid to take responsibility. I mean, somebody wrote a poem that was related to Jewish history when Moses leads the Jews for 40 years in the desert. And he said, it would have been easier to stay in Egypt and maybe even die than to wander 40 years in the desert. Hmm. And, oh, Lucy, you know, from Charlie Brown said, I don't make New Year's, what's the word I want?
Resolutions.
Resolutions. Yeah, I prefer my old regrets. See? And that's what a lot of people, they're so afraid of change, of stepping out, taking a chance. I always recommend the movie Harold and Maude because it's Ruth Gordon says, you know, take a chance, get hurt even, play as well as you can, go, team, go. Give me an L, give me an I, give me a V, give me an E, live. Otherwise, you got nothing to talk about in the locker room. But again, if you're afraid to do it wrong, then you don't step out and you don't take a chance and you don't take responsibility because it's easier to give it to everybody else and then you can blame them. Right. And one last thing, because I keep getting, you know, more and more thoughts in my head. It's hard for me to stop talking. But is that what you see in others resides within you. That's something that I truly realize. And actually what I look for are people who think I'm wonderful. Now, this may sound, you know, it's not egotistical. What I'm looking for is somebody comes up to me and says, boy, that talk you gave was inspiring. Your book was inspiring. What I know is there's inspiration in them, see, that I've triggered it. I'm, as a coach would, and brings it out. But if they said to me, oh, you saved my life, I say, I can't. You saved it. Mm-hmm. I can't save it. I can instruct you, give you, you know, help you, but it's you. So I don't take the, you know, the credit. I leave it with the person. But I have realized that if two people go to the same movie and one walks out saying, God, how boring, and the other one said, oh, boy, that was a wonderful evening. I mean, what's different? Them, not the movie, and it's what they see in it. So I'd say, if you see good things in more and more people, it's a good sign about yourself, how you're evolving and what's happening. So I always watch myself and my opinion of other people. And I mean that in a very basic way, that if somebody comes to fix my plumbing, I think about how did I react to the plumber and the kind of person he was. And I find more and more I enjoy you know, not when things go wrong in the house, but the people who come to fix them. Mm-hmm. You know, I am getting to know them more as human beings and, you know, not just as somebody to fix something and I'm mad because it broke and that sort of thing.
Right. No, I think that's really important. And what I like about your book is, you know, as you said, they're simple practices that are very powerful. And you're sort of, you know, asking people to see you as a coach and, you know, to help themselves. And you know, you're giving tips with each chapter. So I chose about 10 chapters. I don't know if we'll get through them all, but, you know, of what I think, you know, is really key to some of, I mean, I think they're all key, but, you know, certain ones sort of stood out to me. So we'll start with chapter one, because that was kind
of... I'm glad you did that. If I had a choice, you know, because the title is Attitude is Everything. And that's something that I've really come to realize, that the one thing that we're all in charge of and can control are our thoughts. So, and in a sense, I think we induce a trance in ourselves 98% of the time. So if you have a negative view of the world, then think of what your day is going to be like, or your job. Well, Monday morning, more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses, okay? Mm-hmm. So that tells you a lot about what your attitude is and what it does to you. But, and this is a quote from a wonderful medical secretary at the hospital. I walked over to her one day, and I said, "What's your name?" I used to say that brusquely to people who did nice things in the hospital, because mm-hmm. I wanted to surprise them with a gift with their name on it. And she was the only one who, instead of getting upset with the doctor says, "What's your name?" You know, she said, "Why do you want to know?" I said, "Truthfully, I want to give you a gift because of the wonderful effect you have." She said, "Sit down, I'll tell you a story." She said, "I took this job, and the first day I hated it. I couldn't stand the doctors and nurses and their attitude. So I went to the office, and I said, 'I'm going home. I don't want the job.' And they said, 'You can't quit. You have to give 2 weeks' notice. It's in your contract." And she said, "I got up every day miserable for 2 weeks. The last day I got up happy, and I went to work happy. And I noticed something. All the people around me were happy. So I didn't quit. I decided to come in happy." And I had another experience with, and I truthfully can't remember what stories are in the book or not, but where our hotel room was robbed. And when I say that, I don't mean it was broken into. It was open with a key and valuable things taken out of the room. So I'm sure it had to do with who cleaned our room and, you know, things like that. And I had seen this weird man in the hallway who was standing there and waiting. And I thought, why would somebody stand in a hotel? Well, he was waiting for us to get on the elevator and go to dinner. And then he went in our room, I'm sure. So I got up every day for months, miserable, you know, about this guy, what he did, and wishing I were back in the hallway and I could get him and, you know, all the police. And then I realized he's still robbing you. You're spending so much time resenting him. What are you doing to yourself in your day? And that's when I literally let go. It happened to be around Christmas time, and I thought, ah, if he took our stuff and got some money and bought his kids a Christmas present, that would feel good. And I'll give him another $100. And, you know, but I ended up, again, like I just did, laughing and smiling, and my attitude was changed, and I was now free. He wasn't my problem anymore, see, nor were my thoughts. And that's why once people can straighten out their attitude, and there was a gentleman I met who had a pin made up of the word attitude, and that's how his wife became his coach. He would wear the pin. If he wasn't behaving properly, he was dealing with a brain tumor, she'd walk over, grab the pin, and say, "Honey, you got to straighten out your attitude." And those are things people can build into their, you know, relationships. Our kids would say to me, "Dad, you're not in the operating room now," when my attitude would become overbearing. You know, so we all had little messages to each other that was, "Hey, Dad, calm down." And I had things, you know, that I could say to them. I mean, if you don't mind my sharing this one, because the kids would always stare at me. I'd say, "Do you know why your mother and I will never get a divorce?" And they'd say, "Why not, Dad?" I'd say, "Because neither one of us wants the children." And then they knew, oh, we better be good and quiet. But, I mean, you know, to bring in that kind of humor and those kinds of messages, and to accept it from each other. Because I always say that the people that I admire are people who are criticized by the people they work with, the people they work for, and their families. Because the people who are criticizing know you're willing to listen, that you're not making excuses. So they come up to you and they'll say, you know, "Your behavior doesn't fit," or "Your attitude." And you say, "I'm sorry, thank you," and you change. You know, and patients would do that to me. I mean, I might scare them, because one woman said, "What's wrong?" I said, nothing. What do you mean? She said, your face, it's all wrinkled. And I said, yeah, I'm really thinking about how to help you. And she said, think in the hallway and smile when you come in here. You know, those may be simple things, but they make you a better doctor, you know, or plumber or mother or father or whatever. If you're getting that feedback and you say thank you and you get better at it.
Mm-hmm. And in each chapter, you have exercises. So you have a bunch of exercises to assist us to, you know, really look at some of the things so that we can help ourselves do this. And exercise number 4 is about the greatest teacher, refuse to have a bad attitude.
To me, and why I put in, truthfully, the exercises is that it's to make it practical, you know, so that people don't just read, you know, this philosophical book on you know, surviving and soul and spirit, and then say, well, what do I do now? So that when you're done, you say, okay, now I know what to do. And as I say, it's taking what I call age-old messages, because I always tell people this, too. Look for common themes. See, like, what's your greatest teacher? To me, it's the common themes that I can pick out of a Bible, out of an addiction meeting, out of a cancer support group. You know, when people say, this is what helped me, I say, yeah, that's a common theme. And then you can cite all the places it's coming from. And I'd say, then it must work, because look at all the places you find that message. Hmm. So, you know, under this, where it says the greatest teacher also, it says, I asked recently at a teacher's conference, tell me what they thought was their greatest teacher. And my answer was death. And what did I mean by that? That I'm here for a limited time. So I like to take responsibility for my lifetime and not let others, as I was saying, make me miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
at the bottom, see the exercise. And you ought to do this every day. As an exercise, pretend that the day in front of you is the last day of your life. Yeah. And there are a lot of philosophical statements, you know, that really say that. It's to live every day as if it's your last. And then you really spend more time appreciating it and the people around you. You know, when you think about all these recent tragedies of airplanes and, you know, other things and buildings collapsing, and what do people do when they grab their cell phone? They call home and say, I love you.
Mm.
And they should say it before they leave home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not have an argument or leave complaining and whining, but take the time to say, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
And what a difference that makes.
And it's such a, you know, we are such a society that looks at youth versus death. And, you know, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, I mean, it's been around for a long time, and that's exactly what it does. But because we're so focused on health and so focused on youthfulness, that, you know, most of us don't want to look or even identify with our mortality.
Well, I always say that, well, first I announce to people that I'm on the board of directors of heaven as an outside consultant. And I was surprised to find so many bitter people in heaven. And the bitterest people were the vegetarian meditating joggers. Because they were doing all these things to not die.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a wonderful joke in which this lady steps off a street corner and hears a voice say, step back. And she jumps back, and a bus goes by that would have killed her. And she says, who is it? Who said that? And I'm your angel. You're going to live to be 100. Don't worry. And then she goes through, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars of plastic surgery. And, you know, 2 years later, when she's all done making herself young and beautiful, she's in a terrible accident and dies. And when she gets to heaven, she says to her angel, what is wrong with you? You told me I'd live to be 100. I spent thousands of dollars going through all this surgery. And the angel said, you look so good, I didn't recognize you. And, you know, but that's, again, I always say to people, don't try to not die. Do things to enhance the quality of your life.
Mm.
Then you postpone dying. See, our body loves us, but if it doesn't get a love message, then, as I said, why Monday morning and a whole host of other things are problems for us. Because your body doesn't see death as the worst outcome. Literally. I mean, when you leave your body, you're free. You're perfect again. So if you keep giving your body negative messages, yeah, it'll do you a favor, it thinks, and say, okay, let me get you out of here. But if you love your life, then your body will do everything it can to keep you here for as long as it can.
Yeah.
You know, the next page, if you don't mind, the exercise 5, because I think this one, it's really important.
Oh, that was my next one, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
admire your baby picture, you know, your divine inner child, because, you know, part of why I always say I'm on the board of directors, see, when you get to heaven, there's an admission line. When you get to the head of the line, they say, okay, you're next. How do you want to be introduced to God? And in all the years I've been doing this, only one man has ever shouted, it's me, I'm God.
Mm.
And you know, the audience looked at him like, what is wrong with you? And I said, he's right, come on in. And it's getting people to not separate themselves from the divine.
Mm.
So if you say to God, it's me, God says, come back when you know who you are. Or I'm a doctor, come back when you know who you are. But when you can say to God, it's you, it's your child, okay, come on in. And that's why if you get your baby pictures out, and I've met people whose parents never took any. I mean, they were so abused, they didn't have any to look at. But if you don't have your own, then get some other, you know, get a baby picture, see it as yourself, and put it around the house. And love that kid, and respect that kid, and be good to that kid. And you know, in a sense, reparent yourself if you had a painful childhood. Be like a loving grandparent. That's a better way of putting it, because grandparents are more often able to love and, you know, not let whether they like or don't like, because I'm not talking about liking everything your child does, but I'm talking about loving your child.
Mm-hmm.
And too often, I give one of our kids credit, we have 5, because he came up to me one day and said, I don't get 20% of your time. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you have 5 children, which you each get 20%. I said, your brother's driving us nuts, so he gets 40. But I admired him because rather than sit in his room thinking, they put me at the end of the hall and they don't love me as much as my brother, you know, he could come and speak up and realize, no, you're not at the end of the hall because we don't love you. You're at the end of the hall because you don't cause any trouble and we don't worry when your bedroom door is shut. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to let the kids know you love them, because the opposite of love is indifference, and far worse is abuse and rejection. And that's where, you know, when you think of our headlines, killing other kids and teachers and then committing suicide, shooting women in a gym and then committing suicide, down at Fort Hood, that psychiatrist shooting people. I mean, yeah, that is such a horror. And it's about rejection and indifference. You know, and then the revenge, and then the guilt, and all the things that go into it. The most powerful thing I've heard from a teenager who was sexually abused and had AIDS, and I was helping him, he said to me, I'm going to commit suicide.
Mm.
I said, Tony, I know where to get a gun. We can kill your parents. 'Cause it really struck me, you know, why didn't he say, I'm going to kill my parents, like all the headlines we're reading. And he said, no, I never want to be like them. That blew my mind. Mm-hmm. He was such a loving, kind kid.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about, you know, all the violence in the world, nobody ever stops and says, I'm being as bad as or worse than the people I'm complaining about and, you know, taking revenge on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So someday I hope we can all say, I don't want to be like the people I detest, and set an example and give them love and use love as a weapon. That's something I also recommend as one of my exercises. Love thine enemies, kill with kindness, torment with tenderness, and you really drive people nuts when you love them. And I'm not kidding. When somebody, anybody listening, when somebody's screaming at you, yelling at you for something, just look at them and say, I love you. And they don't know what to do with you from then on.
Yep, very big.
And, you know, I mean, I could tell stories about people being robbed, apartments broken into, and who turned and said things like, I know behind that mask is someone you could love.
Hmm.
Yeah. and the man stopped and ran away and showed up 7 years later to thank this woman for what she said to him and how it changed his life.
Huh. That's powerful.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Chapter 3, Humor Will Help You Finish.
Well, humor to me is vital for survival. But I call it childlike because it's not humor that makes fun of anybody.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is we're all, as far as I'm concerned, multiple personalities. If you brought up with, again, indifference and rejection, literally those personalities are afraid of relationships and try to protect you from the world. And it gets very painful to live that way. If you grew up with love, yeah, you're a multiple personality, as I am, but I'm not afraid to go out in the world and be silly, be a kid, and just so people understand, I always say, just very simply, if somebody hands me a piece of paper, says, sign here, I write here on it. Okay? Or I'll go into an Italian restaurant and order Chinese food. And people look at you and don't know if you're crazy or in the wrong way. You know, but in my town, everybody knows me, so they know I'm a nut. And, you know, and when they see me, they start smiling because what's he going to do today? But if the kid is in you, that kid speaks up. I'm not in charge. I mean, I say things, and it's not something I even have stopped to think about how to answer this. It's just like a kid responding. And when that kid is alive in you, the world becomes a much more interesting place, and you don't mind going out in it. Because I always say, I just go to Stop and Shop when I need therapy, and I have fun walking around and interacting with people. As well as we said, that if you laugh regularly, like every 3 or 4 hours, you'll live a longer, healthier life because of what it does to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. One of your exercises is to keep a smile journal.
Yeah. Well, you know, part of why that came up was years ago, I was keeping a journal. And it was so tragic. I mean, my life as a doctor, just all kinds of things. It was so painful. And I used to keep it hidden because I didn't want anybody to know what I was feeling. But one night, I wrote in it and was tired and left it on top of the desk. My wife came to me and said, honey, what? There's nothing funny in your journal. I said, yeah, my life isn't funny. And then she told me jokes that I had told them. Funny stories about things that happened in the hospital that had the family laughing. And she said, you never put those in your journal. And that really woke me up.
Mm.
You know, because all day long I'd make notes about the tragedies. And the other interesting thing was, like, I'd write two words, like, boy in emergency room. And I'd get home that night and I'd say, boy in emergency room? What is that about? And I'd realize you have buried that pain inside of you and you can't even remember it to deal with it. So I started to write a whole paragraph so I'd remember it. But that really made me aware that our life is literally stored in us. When we transplant organs, we transplant memories. And there are plenty of cases to, you know, validate that. But my wife then made me aware that it's okay to make a note about something nice that happened. And I really try to emphasize that to people. And I began to notice those things too and put them in my journal and write poems about them. And it could be something very simple, you know, like seeing some beautiful animal or flower or whatever. Just something that stops you for a minute and says, hey, isn't that gorgeous? Isn't that lovely? I mean, like one morning, I got up, went in the bathroom. I wanted to see what the weather was. I had to get to the hospital and what's the temperature. And the whole window was frosted over. So I'm getting agitated. I can't see outside. And then I said, Bernie, if this were your last day, say, or another way of saying it is, if this is the first day on this planet, say, look around, enjoy it, if you're a visitor from another planet. So I stopped, you know, I'm saying, okay, I'll live the message. And then I looked again at the window, and it was the most gorgeous thing I'd ever seen. Because of the way it crystallized, it looked, the ice took a pattern like ferns growing. So then I'm running, getting my camera, photographing the window, And it was an amazing transformation, you know, from being aggravated to suddenly it's a work of art and beautiful. And if we see the world in that way, and that's why I say, if you don't like making it your last day, make it your first day on this planet and walk around and notice things. And they're very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Chapter 6 is about coming from your heart. Do the things you love.
And how do we get people to understand that?
Mm-hmm.
My comment is, because one of our kids, we were sitting in a group, and I said to everybody, okay, you have 15 minutes to live, what would you do? And some of the things people would do left me thinking, are you nuts? And then when it came our son's turn, he said, I'd buy a quart of chocolate ice cream and eat it. And I said, okay, you're enlightened. I don't have to worry about you. But the other people said, wait a minute. What if what we told you was our chocolate ice cream? And that was the most helpful comment to me.
Mm.
So that rather than criticize other people, my comment is that your chocolate ice cream? I mean, does it really feel good? That's why coming from your heart, not your head, you know, thinking when you say it's me, you know, and you're pointing at yourself, you don't point at your head, you point at your chest. So come from your heart and pay attention to your body. One of the ways I've learned to know if people have had a life-threatening illness or a major loss or disaster is to say something very simple to them. I'll say, hey, I'm taking you to lunch in a few minutes. You know, we're at a meeting. And I'll say, hey, I want to take you all to lunch. What do you want? Now, if somebody answers in 2 seconds, I say, what major loss or life-threatening illness have you had? And they said, how did you know? I said, because you're in touch with your feelings. You answered in 2 seconds. When people sit there for 10 minutes, it's, are you a vegetarian? How much money do you want to spend? Where can we go? What, you know, they're busy thinking. They're not in their hearts. And, you know, if you want to test this, yeah, ask a bunch of kids. I want to take you out for a treat. What do you want? Boom. They'll be in your car ready to go, you know, in 10 seconds. But if you say it to a room full of therapists, they start discussing with you all kinds of things about the meal, and it just is nuts. So live in your heart. And there's a wonderful saying from somebody who years ago had AIDS, and she put it on her refrigerator. When you live in your heart, magic happens.
Mm.
Yeah, and there are more wonderful poets than others. I can't remember the name, but one other thing I have hanging in the house is when, you know, love is present, miracles happen. And I think, let me say that another thing people can do is what I call create shrines in your house.
Mm-hmm.
Take mottos to live by, you know, sayings, photographs, whatever, and put them up all around your house. So whether you're walking in the bathroom, the kitchen, or walking down the hall, you're getting therapy because you're seeing these, you know, when you live in your heart, magic happens. Enjoy yourself. It's later than you think. The serenity prayer, all kinds of things that you can put up, as well as I say, photographs of yourself and people in your life that are important to you or that you admire. It, you know, it doesn't have to be a family member. It can be, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. It can be Jesus. It can be a whole host of things that you have hanging there and inspire you.
Mm-hmm. One of your exercises is called Let Your Heart Decide. And, you know, often people ask, well, how do I know if it's my heart versus my head? Or how do I know when it's my heart versus my ego? And, you know, it becomes an interesting place because when you do come from your heart all the time, you kind of know what that's like. But for people that don't, it's really hard to, it's like, well, do you feel love and inspired and joy when you come up with this, or are you in fear and, you know, you're thinking about it too hard, or, you know, all of the things that, you know, you sort of talked about, but.
Yeah. And I, you know, it really, the words, you know, in that exercise of feel and think, a doctor was doing a study of other doctors. He said, how does it feel to be a doctor? And everybody answered, well, I think what it's like.
Hmm.
He said, I asked you how it felt. Well, I think I'm telling you. He found that he had to ask the question 3 to 5 times before the person answering used the word feel in the answer.
Hmm.
And then, of course, the answer changed completely. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of their relationship with their patients and everything else, and the pain if things went wrong and, you know, complications happened or people died. And yeah. And I think that's, again, pay attention to your body. When somebody says, what do you want for dinner, or which job do you want? My mother's way of saying it was, what will make you happy? Because if you came to her with a problem, what should I do? What will make you happy?
Hmm.
And that's the age-old answer.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, if you want to lose your life, do what everybody else wants you to do.
Okay?
But how do you save your life? By eliminating what's killing you and living your authentic life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the age-old message.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that there's any selfishness involved in this. This is, how do you serve the world? You decide. As I said, you know, not Dad wants me to be a lawyer. Well, what do you want to be? A violinist? Fine, go ahead, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you become the lawyer, you lose your life. And believe me, when people get life-threatening illnesses, I see them changing occupations, moving. I mean, some of the stories, are humorous as well, because I had a gentleman, he was told he had a year to live, and he really felt awful, so he moved to Colorado because he wanted to be in the mountains because it was so beautiful there. I told the family, I will attend his funeral, so please call me. A year goes by, and I don't get a phone call, so I'm really angry at the family, and I called them. And he answered the phone. And he said, it was so beautiful here, I forgot to die. Now, I have to say, I have told that story in Colorado, and people say, why did it help him to move here? You know, I said, I think some of you need to be in Florida. But, so it isn't, again, you know, that Colorado will save everybody. It was what it meant to him.
Mm-hmm.
That's key. So I think when we, again, do what makes us happy, live our chocolate ice cream, then some wonderful things happen.
Mm-hmm.
As a side effect, you know, because our body gets that message. And it tells our genes, I like being here, so do the best you can.
Right. Chapter 8 is find what fits you best. And I like this because, in a time where we're always giving to everybody else, I mean, this is about self-care, and it's the self-care provider. But, you know, we rarely look at ourself and give our own self love. And I think it's important.
Yeah, that was a painful message for me over the years. That because a lot of things were happening in my life many years ago besides my wife having 5 children in 7 years, and I got sick, she got sick. I mean, we were totally exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to realize how your life, you couldn't separate your health from your life. And being a surgeon, and I always remember Elizabeth Kubler-Ross looking at me and saying, Bernie, you have needs too. Because as a doctor, I was so busy trying to fix everything. It was just wearing me out. And I always hear her say that, Bernie, you have needs too. And there's a wonderful song that its chorus is, tonight I'd like you to rock me to sleep.
Mm.
I'd like you to sing me a song. I'm tired of doing things all by myself. I'm tired of being so strong. Okay. And that song I often recite to people, because as a caregiver, you have to care for yourself too. You know, it isn't just trying to save the world, but to know your needs, and that it's okay to say no. You know,
and
because nurses have a hard time with that because of their personality. You know, they want to nurse the world. But if somebody asks you to do something you don't want to do, it's okay to say no. See, that's saying yes to yourself, and that's how you learn, in a sense, what fits you best.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Chapter 10 talks about how pain is necessary. It's life's unwanted gift.
I always love to say to people, if anybody would like to be free of pain, come and sign up. You'll never have pain again. But I want to warn you, get my phone number, because you'll probably call me in a couple of days and say, cancel that. And it's, again, how do we define and protect ourselves? Through pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are diseases. I mean, there's diabetic neuropathy, other problems where people lose feelings. And what happens when that goes on. You lose parts of your body, literally, because you can't protect yourself. So you can lose a toe, a foot, a hand, because, you know, you put it on a hot stove or you cut it and you don't feel it. So we need that pain. And the emotional pain as well. Now, I define pain and suffering as two separate things. Hmm. Because if you suffer, there's an emotional component and you're going to hurt a lot more. Because literally, let me mention this, that because they tell people to do this. Go home, go in the bathroom, put your hand in a bucket of ice and time how long you can keep it there. Then come out, surround yourself with loved ones and pets and, you know, all kinds of positive messages and images, and then put your hand back in the ice, and you'll keep it there a lot longer. And women in labor know this experience. If surrounded by loved ones and looking forward to giving birth to a child, you have far fewer complications, cesarean sections, and need for epidural anesthesia than some woman who's lying there all alone in labor, unwed mother, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, and that's why home birthing. I mean, all these things make a difference. So, yes, pain is necessary. Suffering is your choice, however. So use the pain. And the way of thinking about it is, if you're hungry, do you say, oh, this is painful? No, you go get something to eat. So when you're hurting, always say to yourself, what nourishment do I need? What do I need to do with my life? And then what I call the charcoal turns into a diamond. See, the pain becomes a gift and a wake-up call. And I don't make up these words. A gift, wake-up call, blessing, new beginning. When you say to people, how would you describe what you're going through? Now, others, yeah, there's pressure and a knife and burning. Because they're just experiencing the pain but not using it as a labor pain to change them and move them forward and birth themselves.
Right. One of your exercises is called Express Your Grief, Paint Your Pain.
I wrote a whole little book called Buddy's Candle on how to deal with grief. Because it's important to express it. I mean, that if you bury it, again, what is it doing to you? It's like post-traumatic stress, you know, of soldiers and others. You've got to get it out or it's going to tear you apart. So bring it forth. You can literally paint a picture of it and express it and get it out emotionally. But it's the importance, as I say, of not internalizing all these things. And the other is to not let grief take over your life. Because I found after my father died, I was dealing with grief in an unhealthy way. Focusing too much on the fact that I was going to die too, so I needed to live. But it was more negative stuff. Well, another simple example is one of our dogs died, and I started to build a monument, you know. So I'm collecting rocks. Every morning when I go for a walk, I pick up a rock, see, and put it on his grave. And literally, one morning, I could hear him talking to me, saying, why don't you bring me a flower? And what a shift, say. Mm-hmm. Now I'm looking for something beautiful. So out of the grief, I'm now looking for beauty, not a rock, but a flower. And he helped me to shift from, like, wearing black every day, you know, to remember you're going to die, to why don't you enjoy the day and wear some color? And I'd say that's what people need to understand. And the punchline of my book, Buddy's Candle, which is written as a children's book, but it's for all ages. See, if your loved one is in heaven and you see a parade of, you know, loved ones, of children, parents, whatever, and you notice somebody in line with a dark candle. So you say to the angel, because everybody's marching by, looking beautiful, carrying a bright candle. And the angel says, oh, yeah, somebody with a dark candle, go light it. And you run up, and let's say it's my father, say. I go up and say, hey, Dad, your candle's out. I'm going to light it for you. And he said, son, they do, but your tears keep putting it out. Mm. And that helped me to understand, because I always say, what would your loved one want you to do? Would they want you to keep crying and being in pain or say, please go enjoy the day?
Yeah, that's powerful.
I don't know if you've got number chapter 11, Furry Friend.
I do.
Yeah, because we have a house. I've always been an animal rescuer. Our home has been a shelter for all kinds of exotic creatures. And when the kids were home and younger, they were, you know, I had a whole crew here. So, oh, God, this house was, we broke every zoning law known to man. I mean, you know, we'd have goats out in the front yard and snakes inside, and oh, God almighty, it was crazy. But the kids learned about life, you know, and how significant and important it was. They had a reverence for life because of what we went through, keeping all these creatures alive. And, oh, I have to tell you one cute one. We had ducks and geese in the front yard, too. And we would hatch all the eggs, you know, in an incubator.
Right.
So when all these creatures hatched, they thought the children were their parents.
Aww.
And when the school bus would come, all these creatures would run to the school bus to go with the kids. I mean, the bus driver locally learned, you know, and then when the bus would come home, they'd be standing there in the street corner, you know, waiting for the kids. And some of the ducks and geese we left at my mother's house because she lived on a lake. And she called me one day and she'd say, Bernie, yes, the neighbors are puzzled. I said, what is it, Ma? She said, every time a school bus pulls up, all these ducks and geese come running out of the lake up to the street. And I said, Ma, they're looking for the kids. But I thought that was amazing. You know, that it just shows you all these animals have feeling.
Yeah.
You know, have emotions, have relationships. They're not dumbbells. Yeah. And they became a part of our family.
Mm-hmm.
And when you pet an animal, your oxytocin and serotonin levels go up. Mm-hmm. So you are more likely to bond with the people around you as well. And animals, some of the things I've written, are more complete than we are. I mean, they are good teachers. And you know, we should learn from them, really, how to live our day. I always take them to all my support groups, our two dogs anyway. And, you know, because they're teachers to people.
Mm-hmm.
They sense who needs love, and they'll go over to them. And it's really fascinating to watch how intuitive they are. Yeah,
it really is. I really like your acronym, WWLD.
Oh, yeah. What would Lassie do? You know, when I was talking about you need a role model. Yeah. Well, because when I'm lecturing, I often read this list of, you know, start the day without caffeine, get going without pep pills, resist boring, you know, people with your troubles, and take criticism and blame without resentment, and don't judge people by their race, and it goes on, you know, for about 5 minutes. And people think this is a list they're supposed to live by. But the last statement is, and if you do, you're almost as good as your dog. Then everybody bursts out laughing. But, you know, but it's not a joke. It's really what you learn from all these animals, how accepting they are.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing to me, because we had a house rabbit, and I wrote a book about Smudge Bunny because we rescued her from the woods. Some neighbors let her go, and they're not going to live, you know, house rabbit isn't going to live. And I learned about rabbits, and so she became an indoor pet. But I brought a new dog home who grabbed her and hurt her.
Mm.
But within a month or two, when I would want to bring the rabbit in the house and I couldn't find her, I noticed she's hiding behind the dog.
Oh.
And I thought, that is amazing. You know how much forgiveness is in these creatures, that he has seriously injured her, and here she is hiding behind him, and they're buddies now.
Hmm.
And I think it's a lot harder for us to, you know, forgive and to act that way. But it's, you know, I always say, you want to give yourself a gift, forgive. When you're trying to forget, you don't get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any single women listening, one more study, because I mentioned about bonding hormones, that when you, one study, see, when you take your dog for a walk, who do you meet, how do they react to you? And in this one study, 38% of the women said the man they married, they met walking their dog.
Mm-hmm.
So I always say to women, if you're looking for a guy, get a dog first and go walking, and your chances will improve.
That's funny. I do like the one exercise, though, where you number 51, it's pick a favorite, and it's talking about animal qualities, because I think it's true. I mean, we need to, if we could be more like dogs or cats, then we would we'd be better.
See, when you say to people at a workshop, what's your favorite animal and why, they're always talking about themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I had one young lady who was literally suicidal. And I said to her, she said, I'm here to decide whether to kill myself. Mm-hmm. I said, what's your favorite animal? So why? And she said, oh, an eagle. And she talked about this beautiful bird, you know, sailing across the sky. And then she looked at me and she said, I won't commit suicide. And she left.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she knew instinctively and intuitively, I'm talking about myself. You know, I'm that beautiful. And I always tell people this, too. I talk a lot about reflections. The still pond, you know, that the ugly duckling knows he's a swan because his mind is quiet. He's not resenting his mother, even though she threw him out of the house. See, he isn't walking around saying, my mother's words are eating away at me.
Mm.
He's free. He's gone. He's abandoned his past. And he's on a still pond. His life is quiet. And he looks down and he realizes, hey, I'm a swan, too.
Hmm.
Yeah, but if you don't quiet your mind and your life, you're never going to see yourself, your true self.
Mm-hmm. Well, we probably have time for about one more chapter, and I've got a whole bunch of them. So is there any that you feel are important?
Let me look at the table of contents.
Hmm.
Oh, boy. I had so many things to say.
I know.
Well, you know, I like, in a sense, the last word, the last chapter, the obstacle course of life. Because when you say to people, is life fair? Everybody shouts no. Mm-hmm. I say, it must be, you're all complaining. And then they laugh. Because life is difficult. But what we need to learn to do is, how do you get over the difficulties? And that's, you know, the key, what everybody needs to do. So learn from others, learn from your life. And I like to call life a labor pain, that it's, how do I use the troubles that I run into to change myself and become a better person, you know, and really give birth, in a sense, to the true, authentic self. One of the things it says here, rest time, yeah. You know, I had to learn that taking a rest was doing something. In other words, I had to injure myself in order to realize lying down was important. As crazy as that may sound. But, you know, for people to understand that taking some quiet time is doing something, and that we are human beings, not human doings. So take time to be with yourself.
Yeah, there's so much in this book. I mean, you talk about inspiration and motivation,
right,
and, you know, the spiritual calisthenics. I mean, there's just so much, even, you know, do what you fear. I mean, this book is really, again, it's simple, but
we could go on for another hour, right?
We could, definitely.
Yeah. Because, you know, again, when you confront your fears, then you realize there are ways to handle them. See, when people say, I'm afraid of dying, I say, wait a minute, that I don't know what that means. So what is it you're afraid of? And then when they define it, oh, well, we could take this, we could do that. And the best answer that solved everybody's problems was at a meeting one day, you know, support group. And I had asked this 90-plus-year-old lady to come and join us because she'd been through cancer and all kinds of things. And I said, you know, you're a great teacher. And she used to just sit there quietly because she said, I don't know. What do I have to offer? And then one day the room is filled with panic. And it's beyond anything I could accomplish. I had no answers for all this. And I turned to her. I said, what are you afraid of? And there is 5 minutes of silence. And then she said, oh, I know what it is. What is it? Driving on the parkway at night. And the whole room bust out laughing, and we all stopped being afraid.
Hmm.
Because she had lived through every single thing that everybody else was worrying about.
Right.
And, you know, so she became a great teacher.
Hmm.
And I think that's what we all need to learn, that you get to be 95, you're not afraid of the dark cave and the tiger. It becomes a little kitten, you know, when you want to go in and claim a treasure that scared you when you were younger. Now you suddenly realize there's nothing to be afraid of. Go. Yeah.
Yeah. Key. Well, Dr. Bernie Siegel, you have been a delight.
Thank you.
I hope that we can do this again, because I think that, you know, we've got lots we could say, and I think our listeners would love to hear you.
We can go on.
Yeah, we
could.
And
let me say this. See, you have to be a delight, or you wouldn't call me that. So please, I mean that. Give yourself a little pat on the back there.
Thank you.
All right.
You have your own show that you do once a month.
Oh, yeah. HealthyLife.net. I mean, I do it on the first Tuesday of every month at noon.
Right.
But, you know, they have archives so you can listen to me and interviewing people and all kinds of things.
Perfect. And how can people reach you?
Oh, the best way, I'm glad you mentioned that, Bernie Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L, BernieSiegelMD.com. That's my website, and the contact comes directly to me, because I always relate to the world. I don't have a staff of 10 people, you know. So if people want to read lots of my articles, which I think can be very helpful, on there, and yes, the books I've written, audios and things of this sort, but also if they need to communicate, it's right there.
Perfect. Well, again, it's been a delight, and I hope we connect again soon.
All right, Lori.
Thank you.
Give me a holler, and I will do it.
Awesome.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.